Hi everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel, and I'm really excited for today's guest. Now, today's guest is one of the most influential people in education around the globe. Gavin McCormack is a co-founder of Upschool.co, a platform that empowers students to learn entrepreneurial skills that have real impact. And some of the stories that he tells about the impact of Upschool in this episode is mind-blowing. I actually literally got goosebumps when he was telling me about like some of the stories. And when I actually chatted with him after we stopped the podcast, Gavin mentioned about, I didn't actually include this one in his book, and we talk about the book as well, but because there's a lot more stories. And so I'm actually super excited to read his book, which is coming out or later this year in a few more, or a month or two, which is called Raising Resilient Children, which is going to be an absolute bestseller. And I'm going to pre-order my copy right after we finish this recording. So Raising Resilient Children, seven steps to helping children thrive in the classroom and beyond. Now, we talk a little bit about his book, but also we talk about Upschool and how that came about. We actually dive into Gavin's background. Now, Gavin is very well known in education, as I said. He's won a number of awards. He's a TEDx speaker, a Montessori Australia ambassador. He's just recently won an award for outstanding global contribution to education in Dubai, which is a fantastic honor as well. So I always wanted to find out how Gavin got into education, and we go through that. It might be a bit of a surprising story. It's a great story how he got into it. And I won't give away too much now, but it really only sometimes takes one person to send you on a direction. And some of the other things that we discussed. Now, we had a bit of a wide-ranging conversation, but I really loved all the actionable takeaways that Gavin provided, particularly around like understanding that education must be human first. Really important. Building those connections with the students to show that you care. And we go through about the importance of that and the neuroscience behind it, but also some practical activities about how you can actually do it. We talk about the power that teachers can have on someone. And sometimes we don't realize it, but it's important to understand. And Gavin dives into a bit of the neuroscience behind it, that we do shape our young people's minds, particularly as a parent, but also as a teacher. That's where they're going to get most of their habits from. And he talks about how you can provide those good habits as well. So this is a brilliant episode. Now, before we get into it, particularly if you enjoy this episode, would love for you to go over to the platform that you listen to it on and give a 5-star review. That helps us reach more people. And also, we also about to launch the Wellbeing Wizard AI tool, which is being tested by teachers at the moment to get some feedback and to make those little adaptations and those edits before we go out there. So that's really exciting as well. And you can join the waiting list, and we'll put that in the show notes as well. Now, I'm so excited for this episode. So without further ado, let's get into it. Gavin, welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Ash. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, mate, it's a pleasure to talk with you. One of the, I guess, most influential people in the world in education. And it's a real pleasure. And we could go in so many different directions in this conversation today. There's so many different directions. But I'd love to start with, I love hearing stories about people's backgrounds and how they got, I guess, doing what they're doing today. So first of all, how did you get into education? Originally, a bit about your background, where you're from, and I guess how you got into education. And another point on top of that is the Montessori pedagogy. How did you come about to be really interested and go down that path as well?
All right. Thank you. Good question. It's a big one. So I know you've only got a small amount of time, but I'll try to summarize it as quick as I can. So it's very interesting because recently I was approached by Simon & Schuster to write a book. And, you know, basically, I 5 years ago, started writing a blog on education every day about what I thought about what should happen in the classroom, the role of the parent, whatever. And my friend, after a year, said, "What, are you still writing that blog?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "What's the point?" And I said, "You know, one day someone's going to find it and they're going to say there's a book there." And no word of a lie, the phone just rang last April, and it was a guy called Daniel Pilkington, and he just said, "Hey, I found your blog." And that's why he said those words. And then, up came this offer from Simon & Schuster to write a book based on the content of the blog. And the reason I'm saying that is not to push the book, but when you start writing a book, and I chose to write a book on resilience, children being resilient, it's called Raising Resilient Children. Before I started to write it, I had a blank Microsoft Word cursor just pincing away, like, "Come on, start typing." And you've got 100,000 words to type. And you thought, "Okay, where do I start?" So I literally sat in this chair for a good couple of days without writing one single word. And I thought, I'd better start by telling the reader, like, who I am and how did I become a teacher and a Montessori ambassador and XYZ. And so I'd never thought of it before, really, never really, really thought about it until I sat here for those 2 days. And it's really amazing, actually, because in reflection, what happened was school was hard for me. I was a poor kid. My dad had left before I was born, and we didn't really have much. Mum was amazing, and she moved to like a part of town in northern England where there was a good school, but people were rich, richer than where we were originally. And we were clearly poor, especially in my eyes. When you're a child, you're hypervigilant of how you fit in. So I felt poor, regardless of how really we weren't poor in terms of we weren't living in Libya or, in Gaza. We weren't in a war. We hadn't lost everything, but in my eyes, we were poor. And that was important. Anyway, school was a struggle, and I struggled to kind of stay afloat. But when I was 16, I was in geography, and we just had a survey that said, "What do you want to be when you're older?" Fill in this form at school, and I put down teacher. Now, I was predicted 2 E's and 2 D's in my A levels. And so that wasn't looking really good going to become a teacher. In geography, my teacher, Mr. McKenny, and I only reflected on this about 6, 8 months ago, and I've dedicated the book to him, actually, although I don't know where he is, so hopefully he finds it and reads it and knows what he did. But one day in geography, he said, "Hey, Gavin, can you stay behind? I need to have a chat with you." So I went back, and I was a bit scared about, being in trouble. And he said, "I know you're struggling a bit, and I've seen your grades, and I've also seen that you want to be a teacher. Now, you probably got no chance of being a teacher with those grades." And I said, I felt disheartened. He said, "Unless you do what I say." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I can see you love geography. You've got a spark in your eye when you come in here. I want to help you." He said, "6 months till you start the A levels. And if I give you these tasks to do every day, will you do them at home? And if you do them at home, then you probably get a C in geography. And a C might just get you into teaching college." So suddenly, this person believed in me, and someone noticed me. So I went home and I got a little table, put it in my bedroom, a little lamp from the garage, and I went to my room, which I'd never done ever before. And every night I did what he said: draw a truncated spur and write a diagram, and a U-shaped valley, and an explanation. And then I got a C. I got 2 E's, a D, and a C in geography. And I went to a teaching college and I got in with that C in my hand. And then I became a teacher. And I've traveled the world being a teacher now. I've lived in different countries around the world. And after all of that, in 2005, I arrived in Australia and worked in an Islamic school over in Lakemba, which was gorgeous, full of refugees and whatnot. And someone came to my class one day and said, "Hey, I didn't realize there was a Montessori teacher working here." And I said, "What's Montessori? I've never heard of that before." And she said, "I'll think you're a Montessori teacher, but you don't know it." So I was luckily working under a school principal then who, by sheer serendipity, moved to a Montessori school and called me and said, "You need to come and work here." So I went with him, and then I discovered that education, can be so much different than what we think from our mainstream classrooms. And then from there, I became Montessori's principal and Montessori ambassador for Australia. And, I do talks and lectures all over the world now on Montessori pedagogy. And, it's a long story in reality, but I think the important bit about that story is that if Mr. McKenny had not have noticed that I was struggling and that I had a spark in my eye and said, "I believe in you and here's a glimmer of hope," I probably wouldn't be sitting in this podcast with you right now. And that's just a fact. So it's really amazing and really interesting.
It's a great story. Like, as I said, I love hearing people's stories, and that's one of the the best ones you could possibly hear. And it's something that just somebody like a teacher said to you. And I think sometimes we forget, like having a teaching background myself, like sometimes we don't know the impact we have on people just purely by how we interact and what we say to someone. And Mr. McKenny, like you've dedicated a book to him and he doesn't know it. Like he might not even know the
He
impact. And
doesn't.
no.
But well, I doubt he even remembers me, right? I
It's
doubt it.
amazing. Yeah.
And you know, that's the whole point. Well, I dedicated to my
Yeah.
mum and him. But yeah, what you know, I'm a teacher myself, and I bump into my ex-students, and they say, they say these words, and you're like, oh my God, it was all worth it. It was all worth it. Everything was worth all those hours of preparing those lessons and the tears and the 60 hours a week. Was all worth it because now this human that I've just bumped into is a great person. And I think that's I think what's missing is that whole we assess and we do exams, we get grades, and we're trying to get the top scores and all this stuff. But what we really need to do, in my opinion, is we need to think about what kind of humans we are cultivating in our schools. Real educational success is the citizens that walk down the high street in 20 years, and we have to think like that. It's not immediate. This is not a, a political, we're not trying to get in power for the next 3 years. We're trying to set up a civilization of humans who take care of the next generation and the one after that. So I think it's really important that we reflect on that because I think that's crucial for teachers, for schools, for government organizations, essentially.
Absolutely. And I think the key is there also, you don't know the impact that you're having at the time. Like sometimes you don't realize it. So I think the important point is that like you might not think you ha are having an impact, but you actually are. And sometimes it's not like visible at the time. But as you say, like hearing stories or people coming up to that used to teach and telling you that the impact they used to have or sorry, had on you. And like Mr. McKenny, like he doesn't know that he's had the impact. And sometimes you don't know as the educator, but you just got to believe that you are having an impact. And I
Yeah.
think that's really important too.
It's true. But also, there's another side to that you can be very mindful that you are having an impact. I mean, children between 0 to 12, they have two groups of people that they look at for influence. The first is teachers. So the first is parents, and the second is their teacher. And so they will look at those, and they have a neuron in their brain called a mirror neuron, if you don't know that. And what it does, it says, if I trust the person in front of me, I'm going to copy them like a mirror. I'm going to reflect their behavior. So, essentially, for any parents and teachers watching this, there is a very famous quote that says, "What they are, sorry, what you are, they will become." So, if you know and you are mindful that they are watching you and are going to reflect their behavior back to you, then what you see as the problems in your classroom or in your children as a parent, you just make a note of them and then you just live that life in front of them and they will do it. I mean, I was with my friend's children last week and the little boy had a balloon in his hand. And I found this amazing actually, just to watch and observe. Little boy, 9, had a balloon. Daughter, 4, she wanted to touch, all she wanted to do was touch the balloon. "I cannot touch the balloon." He said, "No, you can't touch my balloon." And she said, "I just want to touch the balloon. Please let me just touch the balloon." And he just would not. He says, "It's my balloon and you're not touching it." Right. And mum came out and was like, "Listen, share your things, share your balloon." Now, the little boy did not want to share his balloon. That just wasn't an option. Right. He just didn't want to share it. And so, there was a consequence that was if you don't share it, then it's going to be popped. Now he just popped it. So immediately he just popped his own balloon. He said, "Fine, I'll pop my own balloon. No one's having this balloon then. If you're forcing me to share it, no one's having it." Now, this is not a criticism of that family. They're gorgeous family and amazing people. But actually, what we should do in that is we can't just say, "Do this," because that's not going to work. What children respond to is if they've seen you doing it, they will then do it. So you look at that and you say, right, well, my son or this child in my class is having trouble with X, with empathy or compassion or so now you know what you need to do in front of them. You need to share your things and they will go, "Oh, that's my parent, that's my teacher, I trust them, and therefore I'm just going to copy what they do." Because almost all behavior is learned behavior, especially below 12 years of age. So it's a really good reflection on us as the influence over the children is what we are is what they will become, and that's just a fact. And I had this quote on my wall when I was school principal, said, "It's never the child's fault. which we had a lot of arguing about in my staff meetings, but I think it's really important. It is never their fault in actual fact, because they've learned it from somewhere.
That is so true, actually. That's a really good point. To be honest, I hadn't really thought about that way either, but they have learned that from someone, haven't they? So
Course.
haven't they? That's really interesting to actually just takes a few moments to actually think about that. And just modeling as well. I think that's like a maybe a term that you could use, like modeling like behaviors. Like, and as you say, they copy or mirror. Like it's yeah, that's a really good point. And I know that like I personally I don't have kids, but my partner does. And I think there's some definitely some skills that we can have a chat about, maybe some things we could do to help out there as well. But no, I really love that, Gavin. And what I might do now is just move slightly towards upskill. Now, upskill is something that you've co-created, I believe. And can you tell us a bit more about it? Is it based on Montessori principles? I know that it's probably more of a curriculum where it's designed to teach entrepreneurial skills, and maybe real world skills as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's a let's call an omelet of education. Just I've never used that term before, but you've said a few phrases there, and I thought, yes, it does
An
encompass
omelet.
all those things. Essentially, in by the way, a really tasty omelet. Let's just make sure that we're
Yeah,
clear about that.
absolutely not.
Disgusting omelet. No, it's when in Montessori they have this this philosophy, and it's called big work, and it's really amazing, and it's one of the things that hooked me into Montessori education when I saw it. And big work essentially is this. It's where you give children free time in your class or in the term or in the month or in the year, depending on their age. And in that free time, they're allowed to choose. And when they choose, they must choose something which is in line with what's going on in the classroom currently. So it could be dinosaurs or the history of, Egypt or whatever it's going to be. But they're going to choose to do a project on it. It must make the world a better place, and there's no limit to how big the children can go. And whatever they come to you with, you say yes. So, just as an example, let's say children are learning about botany in the class, they're learning about trees. And some children come to you and say, me and my friends would like to plant a forest with 25,000 trees, and they're only, let's say, 10. Now, it is laughable. You're smiling, and I think it's fantastic. And they come to you with that, and you say yes. You do not say no, regardless of how crazy it is. If Mozart can write a symphony at seven, that's one of the most famous symphonies that's ever been written, then our children can almost do anything they want. We underestimate their capabilities. There's no question about that. So Montessori has this aspect called big work. So essentially, with Upschool, what we did is we took the concept of big work. And we aligned it with core curriculum content, English, math, science, literacy, blah, 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 blah. And we allow children to take on real actions. They get to choose what they do. It's in line with the SDGs from the United Nations, in line with the Australian curriculum, plus the IB, plus curriculums from all over the world. It's totally free. And what we've seen, we have hundreds of thousands of kids come now. In fact, the biggest five schools on earth come to Upschool. It's crazy how it's gone become so popular so quickly, but I think that's to do with the concept, and I think it's to do with the content. When you see how it works in schools, what happens is the teacher now has all of these resources that he or she doesn't need to create. I've created all of them already for them. The introduction videos, we've delivered them from Everest, the North Pole, the South Pole, Iceland, Greenland, Costa Rica. We've been to the most craziest places trying to beam in what I call the superlative. So, the educational hook. If you want children to absolutely love studying trees, then you better start with the most amazing content ever. So, I went to Bangalore to the biggest tree in the world, 400 years old, 500 trunks, was planted when the Ottoman Empire, planted when Shakespeare was writing Hamlet. Same year.
God.
So then kids are like, whoa, that can't be true. And then they're hooked, and then off they go on this learning journey. But in terms of how it works, what happens is this, just so your listeners can hear. So let's just continue down the avenue of trees. We had a school in India, a DPS, Delhi Public School, Dwarka Expressway, this kind of derelict kind of landscape, looks like a kind of dusty moonscape by a huge highway. The children there decided they wanted to attract their first bird to their school. They haven't had a bird on their grounds before. So they used the upskill platform. They did all this work on trees, and it empowered them to start thinking outside the box. And you used entrepreneurship, and yes, to a certain extent, but we're not talking about entrepreneurship to make money or have business, but entrepreneurship to make change. So these four girls, they decided they wanted to plant a forest of 25,000 trees outside their school. Sounds impossible, even to me or you or any adults listening to this. How do you even go about planting 25,000 trees and getting the cash to do it? So they wrote four letters to a local minister and asked for some land outside their school. Four letters was not enough. So they went around every class in the school, 6,000 kids, and said, "We need your letter too." And they taught all the classes how to write persuasive letters. They then collected 6,000 letters, put them in a huge parcel, and sent all 6,000 to the minister. He then gave them a plot of land right outside their school, prime real estate worth cash, a lot of cash, gifted to them. Now they've got the land, they've got no saplings, but they now know how powerful their letters are. So they come together again, they go around the classes, right, we've got the land, we need the trees. And they write 6,000 more letters now to a local businessman. He gives them the money, they buy the trees. And then they call me and say, "You've got to come for the inauguration." So I fly to Delhi on my way to England. I go to the school to help, and they asked me to plant the first tree, which I was very honored to do. I didn't think that should be my role, but I did it anyway. But what was amazing about this story is that I asked a 13-year-old girl halfway through the kind of planting ceremony, "How will you know when this has been a success?" And she said, "When the first bird comes, and then we've succeeded." And she pointed up in the window of the school, and there was a little boy with a pair of binoculars like this. And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "We've already started our bird watching club." And the saplings are only 4 centimeters high. Anyway, since that time, that was 2.5 years ago, the forest has grown. They go for lunch in the shade. There's butterflies and insects, and of course, there's birds come along. But like we, that is the essence of what education should be like. Think of all the skills that are embedded in that. There's outreach, service learning, persuasive writing, speaking and listening, leadership, confidence, everything's there. But we, unfortunately, and it's not the teacher's problem. The problem is that there's no time for our teachers to think like this. It's teach this, the bell's ringing, move here, do this, give me the results, hand them in, get the scores, put them on the PISA rankings. This is the top school. Let's put it in the Daily Telegraph. And that is not conducive to the future, and it's not conducive to cultivating good humans. And I think at up school, that's what we try to do. We try to make sure children become smart, but they also become, humans along the way.
Oh, that's an unbelievable story, and that gave me a few goosebumps hearing that. And
Yeah, me too. I love it.
that's real world change, isn't it? Or impact. So that's obviously that's the main focus of upskill, to create those, as you say, good humans doing good things in the world. And that's like an example of trees, but obviously there's a lot of other a lot of other topics and areas as
Yeah,
well.
there's 150 courses already there, and they're all everything's completely free of charge, which I think is very cool.
And can I just ask, how have you done that to make it free?
We're just fortunate in that we do have at the very beginning we were just basically building it and giving it away for nothing with no intention of making money. That wasn't the idea. But as it's gone on, we've obviously when you've got hundreds of thousands of kids coming, there's money that needs to be spent because you need servers and computers and all these things have got to be powered. So it's a very good question. Recently, we have released a product called the Dear World Library, which essentially will generate income, which will pay for all of those things. And the Dear World Library is like a imagine an online library that's built bespoke for your school, where when children are doing their work, they can then put their stories on the library, and that library sits on school on your school website. So for the life of, the history of your school, they can see like, oh my goodness, look at what the kids in this school do. They plant forests, they rescue homeless people, they write letters to ministers, and we've only just started rolling the Dear World Library out, but we've got about 12 or 15 schools around the world who've installed it, and that's our business model at the moment. So it takes time for you to find your feet. I think what's important with anybody doing anything in the world is you find your why first, and then the what and the how will come after that. And our why, essentially, Richard Mills and I, was because it's needed. There is a gap in education system where this real world learning just isn't there. And if you put a barrier of cost in front of it, people aren't going to come. So give it away for free, and we'll find our what and how later, and suddenly actually it came to Richard. Richard was like, I've got it. I've got this amazing product. And he built it. And I've got to say, man, like, I didn't touch it. It's not that is not my creation, but it's a total genius. Like, I absolutely love it. You know, amazing. You just think of that. Of your school has a place where all the kids can put all of their digital assets for the life. And so if you're a parent going to a school saying, should I enroll my kids in this school? You
Oh
just go
yeah.
to the virtual library and go, oh my goodness, look what they do here. I'm
Yep.
100% in. And this is the best part. The kids put it on the site themselves. The teacher doesn't do it. The kids go, hey, miss, can I put my project on trees on the school Dear World library? And teacher says, of course you can, Tommy. He logs in and boom. It's just, yeah, really cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like it's, and that's real. I was wondering when you mentioned about giving away for free, that's because I know there's like a lot of costs that go behind that, but coming out with that, and I love how you said, okay, we're gonna keep it for free, and then work it out. Like that is such a good way to go about it. And then, as you mentioned, your co-creator came up with an idea, and that's a brilliant idea as well. That is
Well, you know,
unbelievable.
I don't want to flower him too much, but he's a good guy. He's got a good heart. And, you know, at the beginning of this, he was funding it himself. And that took a lot of doing, but he had a strong belief in, like, all right, we'll work it out along the way. And I'm a teacher, you know, he's a teacher, but he's more of a businessman than me. And so he's got this vision. And one day he's like, I've got this thing. Here it is. It's the library. And it's real pure gold. So if any schools are interested, then of course they can contact us and we'll help them out.
Brilliant. Love that. And you mentioned at the start about how the book came about, writing the blog, and then someone from Simon Schuster contacted you about writing the book, which is called Resilience, sorry, Raising Resilient Children. And that comes out later in the year. Now, the
Sure.
subtitle is 7 Steps to Help Children Thrive, sort of in the
In the classroom and beyond.
Classroom and beyond. Sorry, I had it
Cool.
in my head and I just had a mental blank. And can you maybe touch on, you don't have to go through all seven, just for time, Gavin, but what are some of those 7 steps that you cover in the book?
Okay, I'll tell you step number four because there's a lot to cover and I don't want to give it all away. Maybe, you know, like
Yes,
your
absolutely.
listeners can go and get a copy later on.
Correct.
Firstly, I never thought I'd write a book for Simon & Schuster, just to be clear. And I can't believe I actually done that, which is pretty mind-blowing for me. So I had a privilege of spending a long time with a good friend of mine, Professor Mark Williams, a neuroscientist. I would highly recommend you get him on this show. He'll blow your socks off. He's just an absolute wizard when it comes to understanding how the human brain works. And what I learned from him was that there's a lot of things that we do in our classrooms that are the polar opposite of how our children like to learn in terms of neurology and neuroscience. There's a lot of things that we can be doing which are conducive to the brain loving the lessons that we deliver. And so what I'll do, I'll share just a really cool tidbit with you now and your listeners, which I think a lot of people don't know exists. But when I discovered it, I thought it was pure gold. In fact, I was talking about this last week at the World Literacy Summit. And people were, you know, have no idea that this was a thing. So you're a teacher or you're a parent and you want to teach your child something, okay, whatever it is, about snails or trees or, you know, about life or whatever it's going to be. The first thing to say is that if the child feels that their life matters to you, therefore you care for them, then they listen to you. In fact, your voice will sound more beautiful if they feel that they matter to you. If they feel that they don't matter to you, their brain will just literally repel what you say. Your voice sounds toxic, so it'll just be ignored. So the first thing to say is we all must put connection before curriculum. There is literally no point in planning and then executing your lessons if you haven't connected with the people in your class. Neuroscience would say you are lucky if 50% of the children take in what you've said, because if you fail to connect, if you're like, in, let's go, books out, let's go, no time for chatting, no time to call you by your name, no time to even look you in the eye or shake your hand, I need to teach, then you're risking something big. The second thing is this, that when children go to bed at nighttime, in fact, this will happen to you too, Ash, and all of your listeners tonight. When you go to bed at nighttime, you close your eyes and you fall asleep. And your brain then wakes up and it says, all right, let's decide of all the 7,000 to 8,000 thoughts that Ash had today. Which ones are we going to keep and transfer to the hippocampus or long-term memory? And which ones are we going to dissolve into the lymphatic system? So when in the morning, when you go to the toilet, you literally urinate those thoughts into the toilet, right? Now, the last thing you want as a teacher is your lesson ending up in the sewer, right? You don't, because you've spent all night planning it and
Very
then
true.
teaching it and trying your best. So if you knew of like a secret code that allowed the lesson you've taught to be moved to the hippocampus during this process, which we call synaptic pruning, then you would do it. Of course you would do it, because you want your children to retain your lesson. You want them to have retention. You don't want them to forget it. So if you knew that, then you would definitely act upon it. So I'll tell you what it is. Well, the first part is they need to feel like they matter. So meet them at the door, shake their hand, look them in the eye and say, "Hey, Ash, I heard you've got a new guinea pig." Right? Whatever it is, find something out about them, be interested in their existence, ask them about their life. Just needs to be quick. 1 minute. You've got 30 seconds, with each kid. How's it going? How was football last night? Did you watch any movies? How was your mum? Did you get a new guinea pig? Did you sleep okay? Did you have any dreams last night? Whatever. What happens in a child's brain is they say, "You have spent your free time thinking about my life. Therefore, I matter to you. Therefore, you care about me. Therefore, I trust you. Therefore, I'm going to listen to you." So that's the first thing. Second thing is this. There are three things that almost guarantee that the thought will be moved to the hippocampus during synaptic pruning. Number one, if you've touched something with your hands, the hands are the gateway to the brain. So if you've touched something with your hands, there's a very strong possibility it will end up in the hippocampus. If you're teaching snails, a video of snails on YouTube and a picture of snails in a textbook is very different to a snail at the front of the class that you can come and hold if you want, and the slimy little slug pop out onto your hand. And most people have never held a snail in their life. You attach some touching to your learning, and 100% that is going into the hippocampus to be retained probably forever. Number two, if there's any choice in your lesson, choice is risky, and risk is an emotional thing. And so if you say to your children now, you've got two choices. You can either, in order to complete this lesson, you can draw a diagram, or you can paint a picture of the snail. Now, children have to make a decision now. Oh, okay. Ooh, drawing a picture is easy. I can draw a picture. I've done it loads of times. Painting a picture, harder, more challenging. I'm not sure which one I'm going to do. I'm going to draw a picture because it's easier. Later on, I'm going to regret that. I wish I'd have painted a picture because I saw Tommy painting one and I should have really been more confident. Later on, you go to bed, brain says, ooh, you had a choice. Better keep that choice because it was an emotional choice. And because later on, I want to make sure that you act upon these choices, move it to the hippocampus. And number three, is all about the children having agency. So giving them the freedom to dictate what they're going to do with that work. So not saying to them, it's going to go on the wall, or it goes in your book, and I'm going to tick it. The question is, what are you going to do with it when you've finished with this piece of work? Well, I'd like to go to kindergarten and teach them about snails, or I'm going to take it home. My grandma would love this picture. And so then they have this agency over it. So if you can have those three things in your lesson, as well as connecting with a child, then there's almost no chance that it will be dissolved, and therefore retention will 100% be achieved. But if you look at most classrooms, and I used to be this teacher, so I'm not criticizing anybody. We teach snails. Watch this YouTube video, David Attenborough. Now we're going to do a bit of reading. Ash, can you read the paragraph, please? Yes, I can. Okay, guys, the closed passage. You're going to fill in the missing words, and we're all going to draw a diagram, hand it in to me. I'm going to tick them all, put a sticker on it. You get a chart on the thing. It goes in your portfolio. End of the term, you can take it home. And a kid goes to sleep at night, and the brain says this: "All right, that lesson on snails, shall we keep it or not? Any risk? No risk. There was no choice, actually. I had no risk at all. Okay, well, let's ignore that. Did you touch anything? I touched a textbook, but I touched a textbook 1,000 times before, so that doesn't matter to me either. Any agency over your work? No, we all put it in our folders. There was no real freedom there. You know what? Snip, snip, snip. Lymphatic system in the morning, in the toilet. Teacher has a test on Friday. Hey, guys, we're going to do a test on snails. Everybody fails. All the kids get punished. Whose fault is it? It's our fault because we didn't know how the brain liked to learn." And, this is not a criticism, but kind of an expose, because When you know that, you're like, oh my God, is that easy? Is it really that easy? And it's really that easy. And it's pretty amazing. So the book has a lot of these, this information, analogies, and anecdotal evidence of what I've seen in schools around the world. And yeah, I really enjoyed writing it. So hopefully it helps teachers and parents to kind of, make the journey of education more fruitful and more conducive to learning and long-term, development for our students.
That's brilliant. I love that. Like, I just took just listen to you then talk about it. I just took so much away from myself, and like, definitely. I mean, I still get to go into schools and, I guess do some teaching, but more in the well-being space. But I can use a lot of those things. Like, even if I just go into school for a day, I can use a lot of those techniques still. But just thinking about that connection, to be honest, I did that okay. I think just reflecting, I think it's a great point you make. Just to finding out about something about this child, the student, and just
Yes.
asking them. Well, I remember because I was a PE teacher, and we were a really sporty school, so a lot of the kids did play sport. So when you're walking through the courtyard on a Monday, just stopping at one of the students and just asking them how their football or netball or whatever it what was how did it go, and it
Yeah.
does it lights up their face. Like they thought, oh,
That's right.
he knows what I do.
That's right. And
Crazy.
a lot of kids, if you want to really make it really plain, children think you live in the cupboard and you wheeled out in the morning and you know everything. And then you just go back in the cupboard at night and then you come out every day and you just emerge. They don't know that you go to the toilet, to do a poo. They don't know that you go shopping. They
Yes.
don't know that you've got friends and you
Oh.
like play football. They don't know these things. And if you don't believe me, any teacher out there will know this immediately. And I'm sure you will, Ash.
Yeah.
If you've ever bumped into a student in a supermarket before, what do? They hide behind their parents. Because suddenly they realize, oh my God, my teacher goes shopping. I can't believe he's a real or she's a real person. It's fascinating, the whole thing. And I think that the whole what you said at the very beginning, I think is really important about, modeling that behavior in our students. I think what we don't do enough, and we this is parents, this is adults in general, is we don't let them see us as a full human. We want to be brave and strong and knowledgeable in front of them and be this kind of oracle. I'm going to protect you and I don't cry and I don't get things wrong. And if I make mistakes, well, it's probably your fault and blah, 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 blah. If we can be more human in front of them, let's say in circle time in the morning at school, even with your grade fours or grade threes, you get together and first 5 minutes you say, morning, everyone. Let's come to a circle. We're all equal. We'll sit on the floor together. I don't have a chair because I'm a teacher. I sit on the floor too. I'm a human like you. How was everyone's evening last night? I'll start. I'm the teacher. I'll tell you about my night. And it's not always going to be you starting, but I think it's important to set the tone. You say, last night there was a mosquito in my bedroom and it was buzzing around all night. I woke up at 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And I've got to say, guys, I'm so tired today. Like, I'm really tired. How's everyone else going? And the kids will talk about their experiences. I played football. I went to my friend's house, had a birthday. But what will happen then is some children will start to realize that's my teacher over there. And my teacher's cared about me lots of times. I fell over in the playground. I was crying one time. I was being bullied or whatever it's going to be. Now it's my time to care for them. And they might come over and say, hey, Mr. McCormack, are you feeling okay? Do you need any help today cleaning your table or something? Because I know you're feeling tired. And that promotion of being human just goes, hey, we're all vulnerable. Some days we're all great, some days we're not so good, but it's really important to go and help each other because that sets the tone of it's okay not to be okay. And if someone's not okay, then our obligation is to go and assist them because we're all together and this is no hierarchy. So, I really, in the book especially and in life, I promote being vulnerable, being human, saying you're tired, and if you make a mistake, let's say you shout in class one day, oh, you little, whatever, then saying, I'm sorry. Earlier on, I shouted, I'm so sorry, guys. I will not do that again. I'll try to be better. The children say, oh, so it's okay to make mistakes. We're allowed to do that. And if we make a mistake, we just have to say we're sorry and admit it and try to be better and then work on that. Then, we don't, it's not, you'll know you're a mental health specialist. So that's 101 reflection, apologies, being, human in front of the children in our class. And essentially, in Montessori education, this is a 101. It's something you get in every classroom.
That's amazing. I love hearing that. I think what comes to mind just then straight away is empathy. Like, I think empathy is one of the most important skills as a person we can develop and practice. And when I say practice, we can actually practice it. And I guess
Sure.
the younger we give the students the opportunity to practice, obviously the better off they'll be. And I think that's just that those little strategies you gave then about the circle time, you starting off, the children start to build empathy with you, and they can build empathy with each other, and it's just such a great way to do it. I really love that.
Yeah, and there's this, I can't remember the name of the theorist now, but in a lot of our classrooms, we give our children sticker charts and we say, well done for doing this. And we give them a sticker and we say, this is a competition. Obviously, everything is wrong with that. So I absolutely hate it. I don't condone it. It should be ripped down. Every single one of them, I have every classroom and burned. They just don't work and they're terrible and they breed competitiveness in our students and we don't appreciate them. Anyway, I won't go on about that. But what happens is this. So a child will come to you and say, hey, are you feeling okay, Mr. McCormack? And so actually, feeling so tired, and I really appreciate you helping me, with my table. I'd love some help. And the child says, okay, well, I'll help you and clean your table. Now, the child goes back to their table or their work or their group or whatever they're doing. And other children who are so astute, they watch what the child is doing, they watch how they came to you, then they notice how the child feels when they finished and they return to their table. And they see this feeling of absolute pride, and I did a good thing. I'm a good person. I'm trying my best to help the world and add value here. And that look or that stature or that body language that other people see, they want. I want to feel like that. And therefore, they do it. So, they say you're a product of the seven people who spend the most time with. So if you've got seven kids in your class who are being good people, it's not too long before everyone's being a good person because you want to be like that. You're actually rewarded neurologically for doing good deeds. And so, you can't say, share, be kind. These things don't work. It's about living it. You've got to live it every day. John Dewey said this: education is not about preparation for life. Education is life. And therefore, your classroom should be living, should be like a mini society in those four walls.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I've taken so many things away just from our conversation here, and I'm sure the listeners will too. And I think I can't wait to get a hand on my hands on a copy of the book. And I know it comes out later. When does it come out? I know we're
July.
recording today, mid-April 2025.
July 29th, it comes out, yes.
When, sorry, the
July
oh,
29th.
July 29. So, is there anywhere we can pre-order at the moment, or it just comes
Yeah,
out?
just you just Google raising resilient children, there it is everywhere.
And pre-order, I'll definitely be doing that after our call. And I really appreciate your time today, Gavin. I'd encourage everyone to go out and check out upschool.co, check out the book, pre-order, and where else can people connect with you, Gavin?
Everyone, just Google me. In fact, the best place to find me is going to Upschool. There's a little button there that says, book a demo, and you'll find me there. My
Brilliant.
calendar is this week is rammed, literally with schools just because in India and in the Middle East, schools have been off and are just waking up after their holiday. So they're all coming for their courses and they want to know which course should I do, which one's going to work best with my school. So we offer that service for schools, if they're like, I'm not sure which one I should do. In fact, they did a keynote speech at the Opera House 2 weeks ago, which was amazing. And there were some of the biggest schools in Australia were there, and they're all coming along, which I'm very excited about. So,
Brilliant.
yeah, it's great. And thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you inviting me. And I hope your listeners have taken something away from this.
Absolutely. No, plenty of takeaways, mate. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on, Gavin.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much.